this is an example of somebody who really thinks they're telling the truth about their life and unburdening themselves.
That to me is what's extraordinary.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On today's episode, we discuss The Claw by José Emilio Pacheco. Perhaps one of the hardest things to live with is the life we imagine we might have had. We can spend years looking at someone else and wondering what they were given that we were not. Beauty, love, opportunity, happiness. And over time, that comparison can become its own kind of prison. José Emilio Pacheco's La Zarpa, or The Claw, is a haunting story about what happens when envy takes hold of a life and refuses to let go. The idea is profound, not because it's complicated, but because it resonates. It gives language to something deeply human that most of us recognize but rarely articulate. Pacheco was one of Mexico's most important writers of the 20th century, a poet, novelist, essayist, and translator whose work often looked closely at memory, childhood, aging, and the ways people make sense of their own lives. In The Claw, he turns his attention to something much more ordinary and perhaps much more dangerous, envy. At the center of the story are two women whose lives become intertwined from childhood. One is beautiful, the other is not. One seems to receive all the things the world has to offer, attention, affection, opportunity, while the other watches from the margins. And what begins as a childhood comparison becomes something darker over time, a very long time. What makes the story so compelling is that Pacheco doesn't give us a simple villain. Instead, he asks us to sit with an uncomfortable question. What happens when we spend our lives measuring ourselves against someone else? When admiration becomes resentment, and resentment becomes a way of seeing the world. The Claw is also a story about the stories we tell ourselves. We can spend decades building an explanation for why our lives turned out the way they did, and sometimes that explanation becomes more powerful than the truth. So we'll have to talk about the unreliable narrator here, but it's an idea that serves our discussion. The narrator may be unreliable not because she deliberately deceives us, but because she has become the author of her own version of the past. There's something almost fairy tale-like about the story, but its emotional territory is painfully familiar. Most of us have known envy. Most of us have compared ourselves to someone else. And most of us, at one time or another, have wondered what our lives might have looked like if we had been given someone else's face, someone else's luck, someone else's life. That's where Pacheco's Claw finds us. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss The Claw by José Emilio Pacheco. So, The Claw, José Emilio Pacheco, it's an interesting title for the story, or do you think it fits?
I don't know. I've been thinking about it. I why not? I mean, it's provocative.
It's a deceptively simple story, I think. It's a monologue. It's a character speaking to a priest. It's a character named Zenobia speaking to a priest and basically sort of confessing. I don't know if confessing is the right word, but talking about the sin of envy, right? Which is one of the seven deadly sins. And at first, you know, we're sort of like, oh, you know, it's just what is going on here? And then the story just breaks open and takes us to a lot of spaces and memories and times, and then to the present. And what else can we say about it?
You've been reading the story for years. So, like, is it something you return to again and again?
No. I love José Emilio Pacheco. I love his poetry. I just love him. I love Batallas en el Desierto. I love all of his work. But this is a story that I think at one time I didn't get when I was much younger. I didn't get it. Or maybe I did, but I didn't want to think about it. I had not read the story for a very long time before this last week of reading it several times again.
And it's a very new story for me. It's a very new story for me. And I was trying to figure out, too, why it is such a complex story. And so I don't know if earlier on I was missing the point because I was too young, too indifferent, too ignorant, or it was really just too much story for me to wrap my brain around.
I'll just say I hadn't read this, and I think immediately that this was going to be one of those stories, you know, one of our stories, one of our, you know, kind of stories that have a permanent marker, you know. And I don't know Pacheco's work as well as you do. A few poems and a little bit of a story collection that is published in English. And I'm sure there's more than just the one New Directions story collection. But anyway, the point is this is like, I don't know how to say it, like, you know, pure storytelling, just like no bullshit, no affectation. And then it just doesn't happen that often. Not to be an asshole, but compare this to like a story that we might pick up in a national journal these days, you know what I mean? And just the kind of almost posturing that is so common. And maybe I'm going negative for no reason here to prop this story up. Doesn't need it, but it's just you're in the hands of somebody who is not screwing around. You know, the things you must have heard in a confessional, Father, and here in the sacristy. You're young, you're a man. It would be hard for you to understand me. You don't know how sorry I am to take up your time with my problems, but to whom can I trust myself if not you? I really don't know how to begin. It's a sin to find joy in the misfortunes of others. We all do it, don't we? Just look, whenever there's an accident, a murder, or a fire, everyone is so glad because at least one of all the evils of the world did not happen to them. And I'm like, okay, all right. You know what I mean? Like, we are in this. This is fundamental. This is what fiction, I'm sorry to go on, but I'm teaching an intro fiction class right now. And I'm just trying to like, and they look at me like I have two heads, you know, because I'm going on and on about like, you know, what fiction is, you know, this is fiction. This is it. This is why we do this. This is why we read this. Because somebody is having the audacity to try and wrap their arms around, you know, everything through the lens of one woman sitting in one confessional somewhere in Mexico City. She actually says the date. It's 71. It's 1971, Mexico City.
And this, what you just read, look at everything. Talk about compression. Look at everything that's couched in there. You're young. An old person says that. You're young. You're a man. And also, you don't know how sorry I am to take up your time with my problems. But to whom can I trust myself if not you? So this is an older, lonely person, alone. Also somebody maybe in the confessional, ready to talk about this, but also having a hard time getting started. We all do it, don't we? You know, so, sort of like trying to justify, you know, the idea that we all do this, you know, we're all guilty of this. And then also, as you pointed out, it's 1971. It's a very specific Mexico. It's a very particular kind of Mexico. And there will be more about Mexico later on. So there's so much laser focus in on this person, and then sort of the macro, sort of that, you know, looking at it from 10,000 feet at her place in this world, right, in this place. But what's also interesting to me is her voice, is Zenobia's voice. I think that's one of the reasons, even in the translation, and I will say, to read this in Spanish, in the original Spanish, nothing like it. Nothing like it with Pacheco.
I mean, because I think this is a hell of a translation. You know, it reads like I am in there.
It is a wonderful translation by
Fran. But how would you describe how you feel when you're reading in the original?
That's such a great question. This was translated by somebody named Francisco Fenton, right? And what I can tell you is, having picked it up after years of not reading it and reading the English, You know, sometimes I feel like I'm going to go read the Spanish again just to sort of take this taste out of my mouth. But the English, this is a wonderful translation.
Yeah, we should find this translator and see what else he has done.
Mm-hmm. So the idea of a translator being able to find the perfect voice for Zenobia is, I think that's a lot. I think that's huge. And then right away, we know so much about her. Thank you, Pacheco. But we know so much about her. But he does the same. He finds the perfect voice for her. And this character's voice, the construction of this monologue is the story. And I don't know how else to say it. It's something amazing to study, to turn upside down, to look at it from all angles and see how did he do this? Because this is a confessional. So not only do we have somebody who's possibly a little bit self-conscious in moments, even with a priest, maybe especially with a priest, I don't know. But then also there's this tone of confiding, of total transparency, of like she's talking to a very close friend. And I was thinking about how this is also what people do when they talk to strangers and they just kind of want to get it out. This, I'm a magnet for this type of person somehow. Often my whole life, people will want to tell me everything. And if I run into them again 2 days later, they don't remember me. They don't want to talk to me. But in that moment, there was something that was pulling a story out. And they wanted to tell me everything. This has that sense of it for me sometimes when I've reread it. It is this kind of interesting, there's a confidentiality, there's a just, you know, pouring it all out on the table. But also, I wouldn't say that it's restrained, because that's not the right word.
No.
But there is, can I just say it? There's a tension here with her too. With an unreliability, I said it, an unreliability in the narration, which is to say.
And the discourse on that idea. And we haven't even got to what this story is about.
Oh, I know, we have not. Maybe we should talk about it.
Well, I mean, I think that would lead us into what this is about. So, yeah, I think you should. What do you mean by, you know, this narrator and unreliableness?
So an unreliable narrator, as you know, sometimes this is just a character that's lying through their teeth, a first-person narrator that's lying through their teeth for a particular reason. Sometimes it's a narrator who is telling some version of the truth, and that's just their version of the truth. That's just their version of what happened, even though it might be wrong or misguided or ignorant. And sometimes it's what's really interesting to me is when it's a narrator that's so rooted in the story they've told themselves, the story she's told herself her whole entire existence, that it somehow becomes the truth, the absolute truth. And there's an unreliability in there. That's what I love about the idea of the unreliable narrator. I think sometimes either I'm misusing that term or the whole rest of the world is. But it's what I enjoy about first-person narration is a lot of times with my students, right, in the past when I used to teach classes, sometimes students would say, oh, but the character said this, and I would make them sort of think, go back in, look again, think again about what you're saying. This is a person that wants you to know this, wants you to think this, but do you believe it? Do we have reason to doubt it? Do we have reason to think that maybe this character's misguided or lying or just has lived such a life for so long that it has become the truth? Zenobia might not be what we think she is. And also, Rosalba might not be what Zenobia is wanting us to think she is. But that doesn't matter, because all we have is the story in this version of events. But I think there's something so compelling about that malleability in a first person narration in a dramatic monologue like this one. That's a playground. That is a complete and total playground.
And I hear you, and I agree. You know, I have issues with the concept, because I always ask, like, find me a reliable narrator anywhere.
That's, you know, right.
Like anywhere. But that isn't the point here. I think the point where you're going is like, you become so immersed in this person's consciousness that you're just kind of wondering her take on her own life. And that means you believe in her own life. And that means you believe she's real. And that means you believe that the things in her life that happened to her are real. And that you're even wondering about how she is talking about these real things and whether or not she's being straight up or not. That is remarkable. And so I think in this case, it applies utterly, you know? And I don't think it's a matter of like whether or not she's telling the truth or not. It's has to do with, you know, like you said, like trying to, like those people who unburden themselves to you because you listen, I think, and you ask questions and you're curious. And that provides an opening for them to tell their story, in quotes. And that's kind of what happens here in the confessional. The priest is there because it's his job. Like, he's hungry, he wants to go to lunch, but she's there now. This is not a confession. This is an unburdening of the soul that she is holding the priest hostage for, and us. And it is, you know, like you think sometimes like stories start like with throat clearing and you want to get rid of that. This is the most glorious throat clearing I've read in years. We were from San Rafael, Santa Maria, or La Roma. Nothing will ever be the same. I'm sorry. I'm just rambling, aren't I? I never have anyone to talk to. And once I get started, oh, Father, I'm so ashamed. If only you knew. I've never dared to tell anyone about this, not even you. But here I am. I feel more at peace. I'll feel more at peace afterwards. And then here's where the story starts. You see, Rosalba and I were born in buildings on the same street, barely 3 months apart. Our mothers were very close. They would take us to the Alameda, et cetera, et cetera. And it just, it goes from there. This is it is a love story, you know, a love story in the confessional, in the dark, to a hostage listener. And whether it's true or not is fascinating to me. Like, what would be a truth in this situation, you know?
Mm-hmm. I know. And, you know, when she gets to the point about Rosalba, says her name and starts to describe her, she's in the confessional, but she's not yet confessing anything. She has assigned a kind of shame to what she's about to say. And she says, Rosalba was, ever since we started school, Rosalba was the prettiest, the funniest, the most intelligent. Everyone liked her, and she was nice to everyone. It was the same in elementary school and junior high school. She was the best student. She got to be the flag bearer at ceremonies. She would dance, act, or recite on special days. Studying is easy for me, she'd say. I only have to hear something once to learn it by heart. Oh, Father, why are things so badly distributed? Why did Rosalba get all the good things and I the bad? Ugly, fat, dumb, uncongenial, rude, selfish, bad-tempered. Anyway, you can imagine what happened to us in high school when so few women got that far. Everyone wanted to be Rosalba's boyfriend. As far as I was concerned, you could throw me to the dogs. No one was even going to look at the beautiful girl's ugly friend. And then somebody in the newspaper writes that it's rumored that Rosalba hangs out with Zenobia all the time so that the contrast will make her unique, extraordinary, incomparable beauty shine all the more. Of course,
this is the school newspaper. This is just, I mean, come on.
if you're born ugly on the outside, people find a way for you to become ugly on the inside too. At 15, Father, I was already bitter. I hated my best friend and I couldn't show it because she was always good, kind, affectionate to me. Whenever I felt sorry for the way I looked, she would say, "Don't be silly. How can you think you're not pretty with those eyes and the lovely smile you have?" But that was doubtless only youth. Who doesn't have a bit of charm at that age? So there's already a seed planted here for the thing that goes along with beauty is youth. And this is what she's hearkening back to, although as you know, as we get into it, even when they're much older, Rosalba maintains her beauty, according to Zenobia. But already she's established to the listener, to the priest, that this stark contrast between the two of them is the root of her sin, is her envy, is the root of the problem that she's there to discuss with him.
Yeah, and I think she's there again to tell this story as much to herself as to him. And I'm amazed by the movement from the childhood and high school into the rest of their lives, which is so compressed. And, you know, you can do this, right? You can sit down across from somebody and, you know, summarize your whole life in a few sentences or a paragraph. I had such high hopes. We could just read the whole damn story. I had such high hopes. But from the time I was 18, I had to go to work first at the Palacio de Hierro and then as a secretary at the Ministry of Finance. I was stuck in the apartment I was born in on Pino Street. Santa Maria lost its turn of the century splendor and got run down. It's just this amazing sort of like history of a place through her and her in a few lines, you know. She basically ends up as a secretary at the Ministry of Finance, and that's her life. And then, of course, you know, Rosalba is living the glamorous life and has, you know, runs around in chauffeur limousines with her first, second, third, and fourth and fifth husbands, you know, and there you have it, you know. Yeah, it's a sin of envy. It's also, I think, the sin of, and I don't know, is there a name for this, of being thrilled when other people have bad things happen to them? What do you call that? That's you know, coupled with envy, it's the rejoicing that she does when, of course, Rosalba falls.
And the other thing too, you just were talking about, is that she never left her. She didn't leave her home on Pino Street. And by then, my mother had already died after terrible suffering. My father had gone blind from the vices of his youth. My brother was a drunk who played the guitar. He would write songs and yearned for the fame and fortune of Agustin Lara. My poor brother, all his life, he wanted to be worthy of Rosalba, yet he was murdered in some dive in Nonoalco.
Damn, that is just, I mean, again, that's everybody's accounted for, you know? And she doesn't, you know, she goes right on.
Yeah.
There.
And the jump to, we went a long time without seeing each other. One day, Rosalba came up to the lingerie department, said hello as if nothing was amiss, and introduced me to her new husband, a foreigner who barely understood Spanish. Oh, Father, believe it or not, Rosalba was more beautiful and elegant than ever, in her prime, as it were. I felt so rotten inside that I would have liked her to drop dead at my feet. Worst of all, the most painful thing was that, for all her wealth and beauty, she was still as kind, as open as ever. I promised to go see her at her new home in Las Lomas. I never did. Every night I prayed to God I would never see her again. I would repeat to myself, Rosalba never comes to the Palacio de Hierro. She buys her clothes in the United States. I don't even have a telephone. There's absolutely no chance of us bumping into each other again. By this time, almost all our friends had moved away from Santa Maria. Those who remained there were fat, saddled with children, with husbands who shouted at them and beat them, and would go off to fool around with all sorts of women. It was better to never marry than to live like that. I never married, although I wasn't lacking for opportunities. However down on your luck you are, there is always someone behind you picking up what you discard?
Somewhere I have a, I think I mentioned this before, an essay that Alice Munro published, one of the very few. Munro writes about her love for Eudora Welty, and all she can do is quote, you know, and I feel like this is one of those cases, you know, where you just like, it's almost like talking about this particular story is it's the thing itself. And like you said at the beginning, it seems so simple. And of course, it's time honored, right? Our jealousy of the beautiful people from high school and the beautiful people in general that go on to do those beautiful, rich things that we think are so great, even though, you know, we're secretly hoping they're unhappy and probably they are. I mean, it's fundamental, even though, like, as you said, like we see her, you know, we hear her, you know, this particular person on the earth, you know, and you wonder who is, you know, how straight up is this voice being, because we care so much. I think, I don't know. I'm just rambling. I'm rambling like she is, but I don't know. I feel like how to do this story justice is just to read it. I was just, you know, I was just sitting here reading this again this morning and I was like, okay, you know, this is the standard of which we need to aspire when we sit down and do this.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's helping any.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. You just have to read the story in English or Spanish. I mean, this is the issue with The Lonely Voice. It's like we love these stories so much,
right?
And we try to talk about them, and we always say we shouldn't talk about them. We should just read them, and here we are.
Right. Well, I mean, but I think if it leads to, I mean, our goal is, you know, yeah, we want you all, all of you, all the many of you we know are out there, to listen to us, and hopefully we're helping a little in our admiration and our love for this stuff. But yeah, I mean, eventually you got to feel it, and that's, you know, I guess that's what we want. But you know, how do you get the word out that you got to read this, you know, what is a fairly obscure Pacheco story? He's not a well-known figure in the U.S. I mean, if you name, you know, Mexican story writers, of course he'll be on that list. But, you know, if I was to walk down the hall of the English department here where I work and ask people knowing Jose Pacheco, I would get blank stares.
You know, there's another transition where we left off, where she says the years passed. It must have been around when Ávila Camacho was president, or maybe it was Alemán. So again, these, you know, kind of coordinates or something.
I love that. I just love that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like when we say, you know, when Ford was president or Carter was president or whatever, you know, it's a time marker for people who know who these presidents are, but it's also a time marker for people who don't. You know, I know Alemán's presidential administration in Mexico? No, but I can feel it here.
Yeah. It is interesting. As an older person, I think, this is a generalization, but I think as an older person, she feels a nostalgia, and she feels a nostalgia for the Mexico that's vanished, and, you know, the passage of time, and sort of speaks in these sorts of eras, like we all kind of do, but when we're older. Then she says, the car stopped at the light. Rosalba picked me out of the crowd and offered me a lift. She was married for the fourth or fifth time, incredible as that may seem. In spite of the passage of time, thanks to her efforts, she was still the same, her fresh, girlish face, her svelte figure, her green eyes, her auburn hair, her perfect teeth. She chided me for never visiting, although she had sent me Christmas cards every year. She told me that next Sunday the chauffeur would come and pick me up for dinner at her place. When we got to my apartment, out of courtesy, I invited her in, and she accepted, Father, she accepted. Just imagine how ashamed I was to show her my home, to her who lived in such luxury and such comfort. Although it was clean and neat, it was the same pokey place that she had known when she was poor too, all so old and miserable that I nearly cried with rage and humiliation. Rosalba became sad. She had never come back to the place she had left. We talked about old times. All of a sudden, she got to telling me how unhappy she was. And that is why, Father, and look who's telling you this, we must never feel envious. No one escapes its clutches. Life is just as terrible for everyone else. Rosalba's tragedy was not having children. Men would catch her eye for a moment, then almost immediately, disappointed, she would turn to any of the other number of men who courted her. Poor Rosalba. They never left her alone. In Santa Maria or in high school or in all those rich and sumptuous places she went to later on. So why do you think she's been married so many times? I mean, the answer's kind of in here, I guess, but what do you think's going on?
I think this gets back to what you were talking about, you know, reliability. I mean, this we don't know a thing about Rosalba. We don't know a thing about her, you know, because our narrator can't see her best friend beyond her beauty. And, you know, that's a tragedy too. You know, I think maybe there's the sin. I feel like we set people up as straw people in our lives too, don't we? And I think there's where, again, it really gets to the heart of what you were saying earlier about just, you know, about whether or not this is a truthful account. That's the sorrow of it is the lack of connection, that the almost kind of superficial way that these lives have been reduced by our narrator, you know. And again, what makes it so powerful is how true this is. Everybody does this.
The thing that comes next, where she says that she's going to send the chauffeur. So it says she didn't stay long. She was going to a party or some affair and had to go home and get dressed. On Sunday, the driver showed up at my door. He kept ringing and ringing the bell. I peeked out the window at him but didn't answer. What would I ever do in those rich surroundings? I was the ugly one, the fat one, the old maid, the spinster, the working girl. How could I let myself be compared with Rosalba again? I might be a nobody, but I have my pride. That is such an interesting line to me.
We're hitting a lot of sins here.
Yeah. She says, that meeting is carved on my soul. That's such an interesting thing to declare in this monologue. If I went to the movies or sat down to watch television or to leaf through a magazine, there were always beautiful women like Rosalba in them. At work, I often waited on some girl who looked slightly like her, and I would be nasty. I would invent obstacles, look for some way to humiliate her in front of the other employees so I could feel I'm getting back at Rosalba.
I mean, that's my favorite detail in the story, that she, when she's at the Ministry of Finance, she, you know, beautiful women come in and she's mean to them. I mean, and you know, and I mean, how often do we find ourselves in either situation, you know, where we're the ones being mean, or we're the ones being having people mean to us, and we don't even know why? You know, what did I do? You know, I think it's a funny line, but also I just find this story so buoyant. You know, it sounds like, I mean, so depressing. People might be like, why would I ever want to read this?
Oh, but buoyant is such a good way to describe it. This is not a dark downer. There's something in this voice in Spanish and in the translation that I just want to keep listening to. It is buoyant. There's something here in her honesty or in her unreliability that it's just, you know, I'll listen forever. There's just something. It is buoyant. It's not, people should read the story.
You're far better positioned to talk about, you know, kind of the relationship between Juan Rufo and Pacheco in terms of just their lineage. But I feel like, you know, he's definitely carrying on or you know, or almost in tandem with Rufo. But I do feel almost like, not a lighterness, but yeah, I mean, some kind of difference in the language is not as so heavy. It's so hard to put your finger on exactly, but
I feel like, again, like this guy is just like, he's, there's not an ounce of pretension in this work. You know, what does it have to show us is like, just get over yourselves, you know, and listen to people and create characters that are, I don't know, carry around their lives with them and try and like we all do, try and it goes back to, you know, what you said about people telling you stuff. You know, I feel like that's what this is. This is a character who's telling us stuff that we need to, you know, if we're open to hear it, we can hear it. If not, the story's not going to be for us.
All the things she recognizes about Rosalba being, you know, having married so many times, and the tragedy of her life was that she couldn't have children. She's revealing an awful lot about the story of Rosalba, which is that she will also be alone as an old woman. She will be like Zenobia. And when she says, "You will ask me, Father, what Rosalba ever did to me." Nothing, really, as far as I can see. That was the worst thing. What made me the angriest. "Remember, Father, she was always good and kind to me, but she ruined my life. She made me less just by existing, by being so beautiful, so rich, so everything." But there's more, obviously, there's much more to Rosalba than just how she looks, and that she was married off however many times, and that she didn't live in a pokey place. And it inspires her with anger, and she's no longer thinking about the tragedy of Rosalba's life. There is tragedy in Rosalba's life. There's tragedy in everybody's life. "I know what hell must be like, Father, but even so, people always get what's coming." Oh, that's where I'm sort of, oh no, with Zenobia.
It's crushing. I mean, and we're getting to the end, which I think people,
yeah,
you know, like when you, the line you read about just her very existence was somehow diminishing. Mm-hmm. Her entire life, Zenobia's entire life, has been diminished because Rosalba existed. I mean, this is, you know, I don't know. It does not seem unusual to me. This seems, you know, a pretty ordinary story of a life. I don't know. I'm just so glad to know it now.
You know, I was thinking about how the only other perspective we have about their appearance is from that high school
right.
student newspaper. And Zenobia, and at that young age, you know, who's to say what was really going on with that person, that boy who wrote that? Zenobia gives such credence to those words. It feels like she would rather give credence to the words of this person that wrote this crazy thing in the student newspaper than just the fact that Rosalba continued to seek her out, continued to seek out her friendship, even as an older person. I don't really think that she bought it. I don't think she believed that this was true about Rosalba, but her actions for the rest of her life speak to the idea that she gave credence to it, because she was so resentful of her. She was angry. She was, you know, and Rosalba's oblivious, right?
As far as we know, I mean, we don't have any idea, really, you know, but yeah, it would seem that she was reaching out all those years, and Zenobia's not. I mean, this is twisted. That's why I said it was a love story. I mean, this is incredibly twisted, you know, like this is a friendship over the course of, you know, I don't know, 45, 50 years more.
So when Zenobia says that she could have married and she just decides not to, because she assigns such a negative appearance to women who do get married and have kids, you know, and so she is the sum of her decisions. She's not just the sum of her appearance or whatever, however she grew up poor and all this stuff. I feel like she makes a lot of decisions that keep her really mired in this place. So I don't know. I feel like her frustrations are really a consequence of some of these decisions that she's made, and not so much because of how Rosalba looked when they were in high school. But anyway, as we get to the end of the story, and I won't ruin it, I guess. I really want to read the last part, but I won't.
I mean, I just think, like, I mean, it's
if we just say that people must find the story and read it and decide for themselves what's going on with Zenobia and Rosalba.
Because they live, you know, in that, I don't know. I mean, this is, like I said, this is like on the permanent shelf, you know, it just is. Because it's like a warning shot to us all, you know, and just so accurate.
Have you ever been, as a young person, were you ever envious of another person? Like in a deep way that you would even remember today?
Fundamentally, totally, yes. And I can think of, you know, a number of examples are running through my head that still to this day, maybe that says too much about me. I don't know. How about you?
No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I would dare anybody to defy that they aren't also Zenobia in some way. Because there's always, you know, there's always a Rosalba, always. According to her, Rosalba's kind. It's almost like that in itself reduces her, you know? Like, all Rosalba is in this story is essentially kind. She doesn't do a single thing to Zenobia, not a single thing. So that's why, again, the story feels like, and that's, I think that's what you're getting at when you're talking about, you know, is this a reliable account? It's not. But like I say, find me a reliable account.
Yeah. She has to amplify. Well, they're so magnified in her own mind that she could reduce Rosalba to this one dimension, her beauty, her kindness. And nothing else. There's no complexity to her whatsoever. There's no dimension to her whatsoever. And of course, we know this is not true. But this is how the story is for Zenobia, that her life is destroyed from the time she's a little girl. She sets up the contrast. I'm the ugly one. She's the beautiful one. She's going to have a great life. She's going to get out of here. And I'm never going to get out of here. And I'm going to be alone and ugly. And she just decided that, I think, early on, she decided that that was her role in this world.
And in the world reinforced that.
The
no
world,
question,
yes.
You know? And that's the, you know, I find her deeply, deeply sympathetic.
Yes. And as I'm saying all this, I feel like I have not done any justice to this story or this character.
I don't think it's possible.
I don't think it's possible. You're right. I mean, I'm sure somebody has.
We say that every time, don't we? I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know, but this one, I think that's why I was like trying to, like, purity is not the right word, but just kind of like, you know, like, there's storytelling and there's storytelling. This is not a posturing thing, you know? Even the very best can posture sometimes. I don't see a single thing of it in here.
Yeah. I think we would have to talk about this.
The claw. Now we get back to that title.
Oh, the claw. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Claw. Like, it says, you know, I think I'm starting to see it now. It's like you almost wanted to be like, you know, like, oh, you love this character? Just remember, you know, like the claw, but the claw's you. I don't know. There's so many things. There's
the claw.
Many.
Yeah. It's her, it's so many things, but the claw, it starts to dig in from childhood, and it's dug in, and it's never gonna not be there. And I mean, I think we'd have to talk about this story every day just to get at what the story's really about and what these two people are really about. And when people say, oh, we've all been envious, this story is resonant you know, I've read those accounts in Spanish before. Like, you know, this, I don't want to boil it down to that. Well, we've all felt envy before, and that's the end of the story. No, that's just not even it. That's not even the half of it. There's so much else with the psychology of it. And I would say even with the things that are happening all around her in Mexico and the things that are happening to Rosalba as a woman who is perhaps barren or whatever's going on, there's a lot. There's so much here about life and the stages of life and the phases of life, the phases of friendship, not of marriages, or even of her spinsterhood, not even that, but of friendship. And there's something so interesting in the zeitgeist lately that I'm coming across regarding women my age, around my age, who like jettison friendships, like break up with their friends forever. Have you seen these stories or these novels or these movies? And it's very interesting to me. I've been trying to crack that nut for a little while. Like, what is that about? What is going on? I'm sure it's not anything new. I'm just sort of seeing it, you know, things just sort of come around again. But I don't think that's what's going to happen here in the final encounter with Rosalba. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you nailed it. I think it, you know, this is a story about a friendship and its treacheries, you know, and I don't know. I don't think you could have said it any better than you just said it.
Jose Emilio Pacheco is the author of The Claw. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.